best argument with this term, when we don't have terms anymore. In June, 99-2704, CR State v. Lindell. Arguing for Ms. Lindell will be Attorney Gaskell.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Timothy J. Gaskell, and I represent the defendant, appellant petition on this matter. This case is in front of this Court on a petition for review after the Court of Appeals had determined that the trial court properly determined that a juror, Fitzpatrick, was not subjectively or objectively biased at the time of jury selection. The issue before this court is whether or not juror Fitzpatrick was in fact subjectively or objectively biased, and should she have been removed for cause by the trial court. After determining that, I believe the court also needs to decide if in fact it is determined that she was so biased, whether the defendant, my client, is in fact entitled to a new trial. And as the state of the law in Wisconsin is right now under State v. Ramos, he would be so entitled to a new trial. In this case, I think we must start with, first of all, deciding whether in fact Juror Fitzpatrick was biased or not. And I would start with the subjective bias prong in regards to that matter. In regards to the subjective bias, it is clear that what we look at is whether a prospective juror's state of mind, whether that there is a bias that is revealed through her words or demeanor throughout the jury selection process. In this case, the prospective juror referred to the homicide victim as Donnie, a name of familiarity, closeness. Her family was well acquainted with the homicide victim in this matter. He had been a beer distributor for the family for 47 years. Prospective juror Fitzpatrick had known Donnie for 20 years. Donnie had ate at her parents' establishment, ate breakfast at her parents' establishment on a daily basis. She indicated that she also worked at her parents' establishment during the afternoons, and she had contact with Donnie approximately 3 times a week. She had also discussed Donnie's death with her mother and found that to be difficult, as her father had passed away in the year previous to that. Prospective juror Fitzpatrick had also attended a function, a funeral function, for the homicide victim. I think the record is somewhat unclear as to whether in fact that was the actual funeral or whether that may have been a visitation. And she also indicated that her parents knew Donnie very well.
Counsel, the court is familiar with these facts. Why do you think that after the juror says she thinks she can be fair, that's cause for striking her under the facts?
Under the subjective bias or objective?
Either one or both.
Under the subjective bias, Your Honor, I'm well aware that the trial court is giving great deference in regards to that, determining demeanor. And I think that I'm not going to spend a lot of time on regards to the subjective bias prong.
That's what the circuit court found, subjective bias.
Correct.
No subjective bias.
Right. But under the objective bias prong, Your Honor, we look at basically the reasonableness and what a reasonable person may or may not do in a like situation. And when, I think initially, when this prospective juror referred to a homicide victim as Donnie, that immediately a red flag should have gone up for the trial court and also for the district attorney as well as defense counsel. And I think that, in fact, that red flag did go up. This is, Your Honor, this is a situation where it's not just a general casual acquaintance. It is somebody that has a very close relationship with her family. And not only with her family, but she has known this homicide victim for over 20 years. And when you look at the totality of the facts in this case, I think that what this reveals is that there is clear that there is some bias here and something that would be very difficult, I think, to set aside during any kind of deliberations.
Counsel, are you asking for a bright line rule that we find objective bias when the juror knows the victim?
Your Honor, I don't think it's a bright line rule, because I think it's clear that we don't want to lump jurors in classes of people. We have a statutory bias, and that's for close family relationships and bloodlines. But I think that I'm not asking this court to make a separate class for people that are close to victims. What I am asking this court to do is look at the totality of these facts and apply these facts specifically to this case. And I think there is a difference between a victim versus a homicide victim. And as a matter of fact, Judge Perlich, during the post-conviction motion hearing, indicated that, quote, if this had been a case where there was a burglary and Mr. Harmachek was testifying as a witness, as a victim, perhaps she would have been excused. But that wasn't the case here.
So I think, are you asking for a bright line rule if the juror knows a homicide victim?
You
seem to be distinguishing in terms of categories of victims.
Well, and I think that it is distinguishable, Your Honor, because I think that when we have a victim, we can do a few things as counsel during the course of a trial. We can attack the credibility of that witness, and there are certain things we can do, again, to attack the credibility. In a homicide case, obviously we have a victim who is not there, who is not available, and we have this omnipresence, as I referred to it, of a homicide victim. And what we are looking at then is, in the course of a homicide trial, we have a photograph initially, typically during opening statements, of the homicide victim. We have autopsy photos. These are fairly gory and gruesome details, as in fact this case was, where Mr. Harmachek was bludgeoned to death and his house was set on fire. If when we have that kind of omnipresence, Your Honor, I think that's why it's more difficult in this type of a forum to, in fact, I think the homicide victim falls into a different category than simply a victim who is able to testify and who the jury is able to sit there and view.
Is it correct to say that you're not asking for a bright line rule with regard to homicide victims, but that knowing a homicide victim might weigh more heavily in considering the totality of circumstances as opposed to knowing a different victim? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree with that. And I think that you have to look at a homicide victim in maybe under a more of a closer magnifying glass than you would just maybe a victim. And again, as the reasons that I had previously set forth.
Mr. Gaskell, do you think it's significant here that the prospective juror knew not only the victim of the homicide, but knew a companion of his who apparently was going to be a witness also at the trial?
Yeah, I think the record is fairly clear on that she didn't have a real tie to Ms. Otto, the prospective witness in this case. As a matter of fact, didn't have really many dealings with her at all. I believe she referred to Ms. Otto as somebody that she knew through her acquaintance with the homicide victim in this case, and that she, in fact, had seen Ms. Otto at the funeral home that she had attended. So I wouldn't put a lot of emphasis on the fact that she knew Ms. Otto. So no.
Thank you. Do you think that's another factor that we should look at in determining whether or not there's objective bias in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I wouldn't emphasize that point. And again, for the simple reason that I don't think that her relationship with Ms. Otto was much of a relationship at all. So I would not, and I did not consider that, and have not ever considered that during the course of my work on this file.
Let me ask you about something else. My recollection in looking at the transcript was that the prospective juror also indicated that she had watched TV stories in regard to this homicide, that she had read newspaper stories, and that she had discussed these things with her mother, who was very close to the homicide victim. Do you find that significant in regard to the question of objective bias?
I do find that significant, Your Honor. Again, it's not only that she knew this person. Again, her parents obviously knew this person a lot better than she did, but it was a very close family friend. She did keep tabs on the news media, was aware of the news media, and again, had discussed these matters with her mother. And after her father passed away the previous year, she in fact moves in with her mother. And the record indicates also that they lived approximately 6 blocks away from Mr. Hermacek. So not only is he a close family friend, but he lives in close proximity of them also. So I think that is certainly an issue that should be looked at also.
Well, let's assume that we accept your position that there is indeed objective bias in this case. Why should we apply the Ramos rule here? Why should there be automatic reversal, especially given the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court in the interim, since we decided Ramos, has decided Martinez-Salazar?
But again, Your Honor, they did that basically looking at the federal law. The Wisconsin law, I think, certainly over the last few years has basically encompassed the Ramos decision as it stands today. That is still the decision in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, in their decisions previously, have indicated that peremptory challenges should not be used as curative strikes for trial court errors. And, Your Honor, I think that in regards to that, my concern is in that decision that in this case it's one juror. If we were to abandon Ramos and say that that's the reason for peremptory challenges is to hear trial court errors, then we may run into a situation whereby we may be looking at maybe two jurors were maybe three jurors that possibly should have been struck under a bias prong that weren't struck, the trial court would then allow the defense in that type of situation to then get rid of those jurors using peremptory challenges. And what we do in that case, I think, is we simply don't start on a level playing field. I think that when we are about ready to pick a jury and use peremptory challenges during the trial court process, we want a jury that is sitting there that is fair and impartial and is not predisposed in any way, shape, or form. And if, in fact, we have jurors that are predisposed one way or the other, then, in fact, we are, in this case, my client, I would maintain, in fact, lost one of his seven peremptory challenges.
How did that really hurt him? When you've got a situation where the reason for peremptory challenges, at least many authorities have indicated, is to be sure there's an impartial jury. In this case, that peremptory challenge was used to get rid of this prospective juror. There's no claim here, as I understand it, that there was not an impartial jury. So how was your client harmed?
And I agree, Your Honor, and I've never maintained throughout this that there was a that an impartial jury was not impaneled at the end. But I think, Your Honor, that we still have to weigh that against the defendant's, the violation of the defendant's procedural due process rights and statutory rights in this matter. Again, I still have concerns that when we are picking a jury in the at the trial court level, Your Honor, one or two different jurors that sit on a panel and will then determine the composition of that panel will and could, in fact, affect the final outcome. And in fact, I've had cases, Your Honor, where I've talked to jurors afterwards and have found out that initially there was a 10-2 vote, and the two in the minority have swung the 10 that were in the majority. And I think that when you look at that, and certainly that's probably the exception to the rule, and I understand that, Your Honor, but that is the importance of having a jury that sits there that, again, has no predisposition or, in fact, no bias in those situations.
Counsel, I just want to follow up on you talked about saying that Martinez Salazar, that's federal or state, and I have sat here. I was involved with the Ramos decision, Boucher, Kernan, and Infinitum, so I've been here through this process. Now, you have conceded, take it as a concession, that you stated that your client received a fair trial. And then you went on to say, but hypothetically, or we should preserve Ramos. Now, what is the difference between what Martina Salazar is saying and what I believe they're saying, that there's no due process? Right. What's the difference between the federal law and the state law in that area? You seem to indicate that that's federal, this is state, and we should keep Ramos because we went on to talk about the jury system in general. But if we applied your case, just these facts, to the Ramos situation, what argument are you making to preserve Ramos in this case, in your case, not for future, but this case? What's the difference between the federal and state due process arguments?
Well, Your Honor, I think in Martinez Salazar, they were referring to, again, the constitution of due process situation.
And it was Ross. We relied on Ross versus
Oklahoma. Correct. And Again, Your Honor, I simply look at basically the history of the case law in Wisconsin in this area, and I look at the statutes as set forth, and I understand that the federal statutes, in fact, are somewhat similar to the statute as set forth in Wisconsin. One of the differences that I see in Martinez-Salazar, Your Honor, was that in that case, in a like situation where the penalty phase was life imprisonment, in Martinez-Salazar, there would have been a buffer for the defendant of basically 4 peremptory challenges. The defendants would have been given 10 challenges versus 6 for the government in that case. And, Your Honor, I think when we just look at the history as to how this has evolved in Wisconsin, again, I would simply argue that the peremptory challenges in Wisconsin are simply not, again, mere technicalities. And
counsel, if I can interrupt you, let's just go back to the basics. In the Ross case, there was an Oklahoma law, right?
Correct.
And it required the party to use the peremptory challenges to correct the trial court errors.
It required that, that's correct.
Absolutely. Either you struck that juror or you waived it. That was it. Because you had to use the peremptory challenge to correct trial court errors, and that was the basis of Ross. And that's described in Martinez. And the government wanted the United States Supreme Court to say that under the federal law, a defendant is obliged to use the peremptory challenge to cure the judge's errors. And the court did not do that. It rejected that argument, right?
Correct.
Okay. So in the federal opinion, you could either use the peremptory challenge or not use it. If you use the peremptory challenge, then the federal court said in Martinez, you were not deprived of any rule-based right. You used the rule, you got your challenges, they didn't think the fact that you... Besides, in Martinez, the defendant did not allege that he would have used another challenge if he had it. Did your defendant use all his challenges?
He did, Your Honor.
Did he assert that he would have used more had he had them?
He's never asserted that, no.
Okay, so in that sense, the two are the same. So now you have a federal rule that says you can either use it or not, and the U.S. Supreme Court says if you use your challenge, there's no violation of the rule, the federal rule. Right?
Federal rule, correct.
And left open the question, what happens if you don't use the challenge, right?
Correct.
Court said you got a choice, you got to take it, right?
Correct.
All right, now let's look at the court's opinion in Ramos. The court's opinion in Ramos took the position that the criminal defendant is entitled to his full complementary peremptory, and if he doesn't, that's how we interpret that statute, if he doesn't use it, and he complains, if he does use it and then complains he didn't get his full complement, the conviction will be reversed. I'm reading from Ramos. That the majority concludes reversal is the only feasible way to vindicate a party's right. Statutory grounds here. The dissent says, interprets the rule differently, right?
Correct.
The dissent interprets the rule that the purpose of the peremptory challenge is to get an impartial jury, right?
Right.
And since he got an impartial jury, he has nothing to complain about, right?
That's what the dissent said in Ramos,
right.
Correct.
And that's what the majority opinion of the United States Supreme Court said. They interpreted their rule just as the dissent in our case did. Do you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Okay. So now why shouldn't this court take the position, hey, the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted the federal rule that way. We should just reverse Ramos and interpret our rule that way. And the feds say, that's terrific. You're not violating the rule, and therefore you're not violating the Constitution. They never even got to the constitutional argument because they said there was no rule violation, right? So what's the matter with that now that I've led you into this trap? What's the matter with that?
Your Honor, and that's certainly a position that obviously this court can take. And in regards to, obviously, what I mean to differentiate between what the United States Supreme Court said and why that should not be applied.
Yeah, I joined the majority in Ramos. Now, why should I stay with the majority? Why don't I move over into the dissent, which now has 9 members of the United States Supreme Court agreeing with it as to the federal rule? You may answer the
Thank
question.
You. Your Honor, I would simply, again, say, and I don't mean to be redundant, I don't have a novel argument for this court. That certainly is a way that you could apply Martina Salazar in Wisconsin. But again, I think that the peremptory challenges, Your Honor, versus the four-clause strikes, I think that those are simply two separate animals. And I know that the United States Supreme Court has said, so what? You know, who cares? You got a fair jury in the end. And I would go back to my response to Justice Crooks' statement that when you're picking the jury initially, Your Honor, the composition of that jury is going to be determined and very well can be determined on the basis of whether you use a four-clause strike versus a peremptory strike.
Justice Babbage has a question in mind. Justice Prosser, just to...
In following the Chief's question, I suggest anyway, is there a difference, a relevant difference, between the Federal Rule 24 with respect to preempts, the federal rules regarding challenges for cause, and Wisconsin statutes? Because therein might lie your answer.
Your Honor, when I looked at the statutes, basically they both, again, allow for the peremptories. Again, the difference is, as I noted earlier, in this type of a situation, again, the defense is given a buffer of more peremptory strikes or challenges in that area.
In the federal?
In the federal.
The difference that the feds have interpreted their rules one way and the majority of this court in Ramos interpreted our rule, our statute differently. Can we do that? Is that a violation of the Constitution?
No, Your Honor, that's not a violation, no. This court, again, can interpret Martina Salazar to apply to Wisconsin, or it can interpret the Wisconsin law and the Wisconsin statutes as set forth and apply those to the case-specific facts in these types of, in this forum.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Diane Welsh, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Diane Welsh, representing the state of Wisconsin. Today I ask the court to do 2 things. First, affirm the judgment of conviction of Nathaniel Lindell, and second, to take this opportunity to adopt the rationale and ruling of Martina Salazar to overrule Ramos. The High Court's opinion in Martina Salazar establishes a legally and logically sound reason for overruling the automatic reversal rule set forth in Ramos.
You have to overrule, you can't distinguish.
I thought about that. And given that future decisions of this court have interpreted that it's set, that Ramos set forth an automatic reversal rule in any case where peremptory strikes are affected, I think overruling is necessary.
Did I give a fair summary of Ross, Ramos, and Martinez?
Yes.
So you have two different statutory interpretations, one for the federal, one for the state. Ours preceding the feds. So you're saying we have to overturn our interpretation of the statute that remains the same, right?
I think you...
And adopt the Martinez interpretation of the federal rules.
That's the better course, and I think the more legally sound course of action. I think unless this court can distinguish our peremptory statute, which this court has recognized has the same common law history as the federal statute, and effectively is the same as the federal statute, I think unless there's some separate state right basis for affirming Ramos, it's necessary.
No, it's not necessary. It may be desirable, but we can interpret our statute totally different than a federal interpretation.
Is that right?
Okay.
Is there no question? Just asking you a question. Is there a separate reason? Does this court have one? Unless this court has some separate reason for maintaining the Ramos decision or advocating overrule, is there something that you can think of?
I can't think of a good reason for maintaining the Ramos rule.
Can you think of an average reason?
What about Starr?
So you mentioned that in your, what you talk about Starr Decisis.
Right, and I think given Starr Decisis would be the easy answer, and I think we shouldn't hang on to flawed case law merely because the Starr Decisis allows us to do so.
Well, I think you say it's not compromised. We don't compromise Starr Decisis.
No, I think in an issue of where, in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court has presented compelling justification, they have established that it's not a due process violation. When the federal statute is implicated in this manner, when a defendant chooses to use his statutory right to a peremptory strike in this manner, it does not impair his statutory right, and federal due process isn't implicated. So to the extent that Ramos relied on the Ross analysis or a federal due process analysis, that has now been seriously questioned.
But didn't Ramos rely on the statutory violation, 14th Amendment? I'm asking.
Right, and
due process. And Martinez is, they said there's no constitutional violation, but it was Fifth Amendment due process.
And I think this court recognizes that every violation of a state statute doesn't rise to a due process violation.
Does or does not?
Does not. And
Ms. Welsh, have any of the commentators drawn any significant distinctions between the meaning of due process under the Fifth Amendment and the meaning of due process under the 14th Amendment? Because clearly we use the 14th Amendment in Ramos. And in Martinez-Salazar, the U.S. Supreme Court is looking at the Fifth Amendment, both of them talking about due process. Is there any significant difference that you're aware of between 14th Amendment due process and Fifth Amendment due process in this type of context?
The difference I can think is looking at the Fifth Amendment looks to the overall right to a fair trial and the fair trial proceeding, where the 14th Amendment looks at what the state laws provide California to ensure that the process that the states provide. But I can't think of why one would be implicated here, or either one would be implicated here.
Now, opposing counsel indicated that he felt that his client received a fair trial. He wasn't arguing about that. If I gathered his concession, or if not a concession, but a statement.
And beyond conceding that he received a fair and impartial jury, he has never complained about the composition of the jury. He's never indicated that if he had had another peremptory strike, he would have used it in any other way.
That's true in Ramos, though. This is exactly Ramos as I see it. I mean, I think this is about as all fours as you can get on another case. The only question I see is whether or not, although not controlling precedent, Martinez is not controlling, obviously, whether or not we should take the reasoning of Martinez, which was also the reasoning in the dissent of Ramos and overrule Ramos. Am I fairly stating this case?
Yes, and I think there's a slight difference between Martinez Salazar and the dissent in Ramos.
Yes.
And for instance, in Martinez Salazar and in Seventh Circuit cases applying Martinez Salazar, you know, they look at first looking at is there an impairment of a statutory or constitutional right, and then evaluating that right for harm. And there may be another harm besides having a fair and impartial jury. Other substantial trial rights might be implicated. And that's what I would urge this court to adopt as the framework. Whereas in the dissent, looking at the facts of that case, you know, or these types of cases, it looked at the only harm being whether or not the jury that ultimately said was fair and impartial. So for instance, if a trial court judge deprived the defendant of all of his peremptory strikes, just said, I'm mad at you, you're not getting any peremptory strikes this time. You know, even if the jury that sits is fair and impartial, I would say that his right to a substantial trial right was impaired and he should get a new trial.
Well, let me see if I can give you a reason to retain the Ramos decision. There was no objective or subjective bias in the case, so that we don't reach Ramos. How do you respond?
And I think you don't need to reach that question here, but given this court's role as providing the law for the state, I think it's important to reach today, even if you don't need to. You know, as the state maintains, as the trial court found, as the Court of Appeals found, Ms. Fitzpatrick was not biased. However, this is an important question, and this is the only court in the state that can apply Martinez Salazar and overrule Ramos.
Well, was there subjective or objective bias?
No. Ms. Fitzpatrick repeatedly stated she could be a fair and impartial juror. The defendant, who has the burden of establishing bias, you know, if to maintain his motion to dismiss her for cause, failed to establish that she was either subjectively or objectively biased.
So you want us to say, you know, there was no bias, either subjective or objective, on the part of this juror. Everything was kosher in La Crosse County. And we're also getting rid of the Ramos decision. Is that what you want us to say?
Yes. And I
think... Any other questions?
Counsel, are you finished responding? Counsel. Ramos was decided in 1997. This case was tried in 1998. By the way, I should say I feel the ghost of Paul Lunston. you are the successor to Paul Lunston, and a very evil successor,
I hope so. And he won't mind if I, you know, succeed where he has failed.
No angels.
We always had fun with him up here on these cases. Getting back to my point here, in the Ramos case, the concurrence pointed out that in close cases, the circuit court should err on the side of getting rid of the jury, and pointed out further that we have said this on a number of occasions. Now here, a trial that occurred about 6 months, 8 months after Ramos, and I presume that Ramos was certainly known by the parties at that point, you had what I think any reasonable person would say was some close questions, certainly on the issue of objective bias. I think you'd even have to agree that's a close question. That's a tough question that reasonable minds would disagree on. And yet the judge, instead of erring on the side of striking that juror, did exactly what Ramos said he shouldn't be doing and kept them on. And if we go your way, it seems to me that the concurrence was also correct in pointing out that this, if we reverse Ramos, we are at least arguably creating a disincentive for judges in a close case to strike the juror for cause. Now this seems to me, this case, Lindell, seems to me to be a hallmark as to why we have to keep Ramos. At least I'll say that arguably. Because, for whatever reason, and I don't know how many other jurors Judge Perlick had sitting out there, Judge Perlick looked at this case and said, keep him on. He should have dropped him. Arguably. So, what do we do? What's your reaction?
As the court indicated in Martinez-Salazar, challenges for cause and rulings on them are fast-paced, made on the spot, and under pressure. Counsel, as well as the court in that setting, must be prepared to decide, often between shades of gray, by the minute. You know, the court has indicated that she was extremely genuine. She thought about her responses. She wasn't emotional. She repeatedly assured the court that she could be fair and impartial. So perhaps on a cold record, it seems like a closer call, but you know, Judge Perlick decided that she could be a fair and impartial juror. I think courts have an incentive to excuse biased jurors. That incentive is provided in Gesch. You know, if a biased juror sits on the jury, there's automatic reversal. So, and trial courts don't want their convictions overturned. So we still have an automatic reversal rule as an incentive to courts, even if we remove this incentive created by Ramos.
Yes, but you're forcing the defendant to take a very difficult choice.
With all due respect, we're not forcing the defendant to do anything. Both the defense counsel and the prosecutor may choose to use their peremptory strikes to remove the biased juror. And as I indicated, when we provide training to prosecutors, we encourage them, if they perceive that the judge has erred, that they should step in and use a peremptory strike so that a juror doesn't sit. A biased juror does not actually sit, leading to reversal. And if it's fair for the state to use the peremptory strikes in that manner, why is it not fair for the defense to be presented with that same choice? Isn't that a level playing field?
If that's what you're teaching prosecutors, what will you teach them if we agree with you?
The same thing, because the Gesch rule will still apply. We still want to avoid having any, well, first and foremost, we want to avoid having any biased juror on the jury. And secondly, we want to uphold that conviction.
What will the state's position be, which is not decided in Martinez, that you exercise your peremptory rights, the defense, but doesn't strike this juror? He says, look, I'm going to take my chances. The judge was wrong. This will be upheld on appeal. I'm going to knock off others. As long as you don't do it on race grounds, that is what a peremptory means, right? Maybe gender, race and gender, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the next case, they leave on DF, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
DF. And use all their peremptories and can even give good reasons for using all their peremptories if forced to, which they would not be. and now say they didn't get a fair trial? State going to say terrific, or is the state going to say you waived it?
Well, in Gesch, we argued that it was waived, and this court didn't accept that. And I think...
Well, if it's stare decisis, you know, you shouldn't use it for bad cases.
No, and I think in this, you know, I can't predict what will be argued. You know, those aren't the facts here. But I would suspect that given the Gesch ruling and Martinez-Salazar, which is consistent with Gesch, it would be harder to argue to change the Gesch rule. I think...
Martinez does not cover that, specifically doesn't.
The government argued that he should have been, that's a requirement that defendants use peremptory strikes in that way. And
right, but it's an open question. Isn't that what the concurrence we're talking about?
Well, the concurrence and dissent, the concurrence suggests that the majority didn't need to reach that, and that... and doesn't necessarily concur in reaching that decision, but I believe the majority reaches it and says that, you know, there's no requirement that he uses the peremptory strikes in that way. And Justice Scalia suggests that under...
You got dicta in that case. That's
right.
How you're going to distinguish Martinez again. What other,
if I could jump in here, categories of statutory or constitutional violations require automatic reversal without a showing of harm?
A total deprivation of counsel when the defendant's right to be present is denied, when a defendant is actually tried by an unfair judge or jury.
None of those go to striking a juror.
Exactly. So it's significant constitutional errors. Most other constitutional and statutory errors are analyzed for harm. And that would be consistent with the statutory rule we have requiring that errors are judged for harm before there's reversal. Section 805.18 sub 2 specifically indicates that jury selection errors are to be evaluated for harm before there's reversal. So I think the legislature has considered that there might be errors in jury selection and has directed courts to conduct a harm analysis before reversing.
Counsel, looking around in other states, you know, we have Martinez-Salazar, but prior to that, years ago, where was Wisconsin when we adopted the Ramos rule? Where were we in relation to other states in the jury?
We were in the minority, but there were other states that had the Ramos rule. Since Martinez-Salazar, at least two states have reversed the Ramos-type rule, and at least two states have called into question their rule.
And the reason for their reversal or their, quote, rightness, their decisions or whatever, what was it primarily what we've been discussing here as far as, were there any other reasons that they gave?
The ones that I've looked at have looked at reliance on Martinez-Salazar has providing a reason to depart from stare decisis. In Kentucky, in a decision where the majority determined there was no bias, the dissent thought that the prospective juror was biased, but then questioned the value of the automatic reversal rule and said, you know, something, you know, that I don't know how we ever decided that was appropriate. And given Martinez-Salazar, let's reevaluate that.
Counsel, one question on the record. Do you agree with your opposing counsel that Lindell exhausted all of his challenges here?
Yes. And I cite, in my brief, in chief, I cite to the record, it was attached to a pleading, a post-conviction pleading. The juror sheet was attached to the defendant's pleading. So it's not a standalone document in the record, but there's a document in the record that indicates. It also indicates that he used his first choice to remove prospective juror Fitzpatrick, which I think supports the Martinez-Salazar view that, you know, he was not forced to do it. You know, this wasn't his seventh and final selection after, you know, after the prosecutor failed to strike her repeatedly. You know, this is his very first choice, his very first opportunity, as it was in Ramos. He chose to strike her.
Counsel, you said that you thought the dissent in Ramos was too broad, and broad may not have been the right word that you used on me. I may not remember it correctly. Because you thought that there were some issues in peremptory challenges that would deprive the defendant of due process. And the example you gave was if the trial court intentionally deprived them of all peremptory rights, or it did it by way of not striking for cause and forcing them to strike, that kind of thing, I gather. Anything else? Any other challenges to any other errors or deviations in the jury selection that will should be court should note if it should decide to adopt the dissent in Ramos?
I think at each case should be, if each time there is an first, if the court decides there has been an impairment of the substantial right, the statutory right to peremptories, then it must examine at each impairment for harm. I don't think, and that will be harm not only in whether the mere fact that a fair and impartial jury sat might be one means of evaluating or not harm existed, but there may be other. I can't predict what type of cases. In the Seventh Circuit recently in U.S. versus Harbin, there was a situation where they decided that the use of peremptories was impaired and that the defendant was harmed because of that.
And what Ramos does is, in effect, if you force him to use a peremptory for a cause case, that is a substantial impairment of statutory right. That's what Ramos held. And you're saying, no, it's not.
Exactly. It's not an impairment. And
so that's
also
the test, the state's test, substantial impairment to a statutory right.
And then deciding if the substantial impairment of this statutory right is one that requires reversal.
I want to try to understand how this would work if you prevail both on the objectivity or subjective bias and on the Ramos issue. Suppose we had a situation in which each side had three peremptory strikes. Suppose you had seven or eight people like the app. Suppose the defendant strikes three of those people through peremptory challenges, and the state goes along and strikes another two. But you get two or three people on the jury just like the app. Is that okay? Or what would the defense do in a situation like that?
Because we maintain that DF is not biased. He was tried by a fair and impartial jury, and he received all he was entitled to.
So it's just the way it is, huh?
Well, but so suppose the court disagrees with the appellate court.
The appellate court decides that a juror like DF was biased,
well,
then
he
would get reversal under the Sixth Amendment.
You want the rule in this case to be that there is no bias of any kind with respect to DF.
In this case, we don't believe that DF was biased, correct?
So, you have no objection then to two or three people exactly like DF sitting on the jury.
Counsel, I feel like, what's a person to do? Ramos, that you want us to overrule, was not a,
isolated case that we decided a few years ago and then laid to rest, and now we are to wake up and see the errors of our way. Ramos was one of those rare cases in the last 5 or 6 years that repeated itself, and as Justice Babbage earlier made comments about Paul Lundstrom, who showed up in one of the cases right after Ramos, in the Farron case, and I cited him saying, hey, here he is. I think this is the most important case that I have ever had. I haven't been a lawyer forever, about 15 years at this, but this is by far the most important case I've ever had. I quote him in order to preserve his memory. So we had Ramos, and then we had, a case after that, we said, no, we're sticking with Ramos. And a case after that, no, we're sticking with Ramos. And a case after that, and the majority said, no, we're sticking with Ramos. Well, what do we do? I mean, we've consistently, many times said we're sticking with Ramos in the last 2 or 3 years. We narrowed it, clarified it, but we're sticking with Ramos. We've had so many opportunities. And now I see the Martinez case, in my mind, perhaps not precisely, but essentially adopting some of the rationale of the dissent in interpreting the federal statute rather than our interpretation of the state statute. It's not controlling authority. It happens to agree with what I think of Ramos. But what does that do to, stare decisis? What does that do to a case where we've probably not had, and I may be exaggerating, but I think I'm accurate, no issue before this court as many times in the last 5 years as we've had a Ramos issue, and we've consistently endorsed Ramos. So why should we change now?
Because changing it won't directly affect how trial courts make their rulings. They are still urged under State versus Lewis to err on the side of caution. Not every court will do that, but they still have that urging. You've set forth standards, with objective bias, and statutory bias. You've attempted to give the trial courts more guidance. So how they rule will not be affected, or should not be affected, by whether or not you keep or eliminate the Ramos rule. Trial courts should be trusted to follow the law. They're sworn to uphold the laws of the state. They shouldn't need the incentive of having a decision overturned, just to follow the law. So I think the purpose of Ramos is maintained, even if that trial courts should strike biased jurors for cause and not hold defendants to use the peremptories for them. Even if you overrule the decision and the automatic reversal rule that it created. And I think Martinez-Salazar provides compelling justification because not only does it agree with the dissent, but to the extent the majority relied on how the Oklahoma rule was different than the Wisconsin rule to distinguish, we don't require defendants to use a peremptory strike to cure trial court error. Therefore, we're not like Oklahoma, and Ross versus Oklahoma doesn't apply to us. But now, we're very much like the federal rule, and Martinez-Salazar is analogous and provides compelling justification as well as legally and logically sound rationale for stepping away from the Ramos holding. And that's what I urge this court to do. And this is a case where the defendant doesn't even argue with the composition of his jury. He's not even saying, but for this error, and my decision to correct the error, I would have altered that jury one iota.
That's the same as Ramos.
Exactly. It's a clear demonstration of no harm of any kind.
The amicus brief talking about Ross says Martinez leaves intact its holding in Ross, which held that state law governs peremptory strikes in state cases. Do you disagree with that interpretation, Ross?
No, but I think we look at state law and the legislature who created the peremptory statute, and the common law that shaped it. but, you know, our state legislature has said that when there are errors affecting jury selection, we should do a harmless error analysis. And I think that aspect of the state law also has to be considered and was not in Ramos.
Now, and furthermore, as I indicated, I was in the majority, so I could admit error, obviously, but it's worth your thought here as to what we're going to do. The legislature can change. In other words, you have a number of peremptory strikes. If 4 or 6, that could be altered by the legislature as they saw fit, depending upon what they decide also. So the reason for my question, I'm listening to Justice Bradley ask the reasons why we may or may not want to change, looking at what other states, and that's why I recall we were in the minority when we went the Ramos direction, and you're saying that even after Martinez-Salazar, at least 2 states have now changed that were in the minority also on Ramos.
Yes, you remain in the minority.
Could the legislature revise this statute and say you have X number of peremptories, but if you fail to use them for to strike a juror in which the trial court erred, you've waived that right?
Effectively changing the Gesch rule.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, adopting Martinez by statute.
Martinez doesn't say you waive your right to complain about a juror if you don't peremptorily strike the juror.
They can do the waiver, or they can take the opposite view that Martinez took, right?
Yes.
It says your choices. If you strike, that's the end of it. You have no statutory right left. If you fail to strike, you take your chances on appeal. Either way, the legislature could change this rule, right? You're asking the court to change it via decision making, put a different interpretation on it.
Exactly, and I think because it's the court's interpretation of the statutes, I'm asking them to adjust their interpretation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Could I ask one last question? The court issued 4 decisions with O'Shea. 1999, I believe it was. Have you detected any change in the practice of selecting jurors and strikes for cause in the trial courts post that period of time? Is there any change in the practice?
I've only been with the Department of Justice for 3 years, and so I personally haven't detected it. And what we don't see are cases where there's not error. So if the prosecutor removed a biased juror, or if the trial court removed the biased juror, we don't see those cases, so we get a skewed view. You know, we don't see a lot of these types of cases, so I don't think that it's a common problem. But perhaps if this court saw a lot of cases like this, perhaps it was a more common problem.
Justice Babbitt.
I'd like you to comment on another aspect of this, and that is that I think that the reason I supported Ramos was because I felt at the time that if we went the way you wanted to go today, you were not giving the defendant a level playing field in the selection of a jury. That, and as a preface, let me note that I tried a lot of cases. The exchange between myself and the jury, and why I would peremptorily strike one juror as opposed to another, was based a great deal on intuition, on body language, on a lot of things that I really, if I was asked to articulate them, I could not, probably. But I had a pretty strong feeling. So, and that was as a prosecutor, as well as a defense. So here,
you're asking for a rule that would allow the state to exercise that intuitive strike. I don't like the way that juror number 10 looked at me when I asked this question. I don't like the background. I think the background of this juror is such that they have a proclivity towards going one way or the other. And there's a whole science building up on that. And so you're saying here that in this case, the state would have four strikes based on intuition, but the defendant would only have three based on that, because the defendant has to use one of these strikes that the judge should have otherwise used for him.
No.
Respond to that argument?
No, I'm saying that both the defendant and the prosecutor have four strikes, and they can choose to use them however they see fit. And either the prosecutor or the defense attorney can use one of those peremptory strikes to remove the juror that the trial court failed to dismiss for cause if that was justified.
You think it really works that way?
I hope so. And I think because prosecutors are supposed to be ministers of justice. They're not supposed to just be going for the win. They're supposed to be seeking justice. They have an interest in having a fair and impartial jury. If they have to retry the case, it's not just their office resources that are taxed. It's the victims, it's the witnesses, it's the taxpayers, it's more jurors. So, I hope that they are trying. And routinely I read records where prosecutors are trying to correct either mistakes made by defense counsel or the trial court. So I think this is how it can work. And both are given a choice. If the defendant wants to preserve the issue for appeal, he can let the biased juror sit and get a whole new trial if he's convicted.
Did the DA in this case object to the removal of this juror for cause?
Not at all. He didn't argue against her removal at all.
Would there have been any basis to argue for the removal?
Argue against the removal or for the removal?
Either way.
Well, for instance, oftentimes when one side makes the motion for strike, the other side opposes it. When the defense counsel opposed her because she knew the victim, the DA didn't support the motion or oppose the motion.
Was silent.
And didn't do anything to attempt to rehabilitate her. This isn't the case where the district attorney or the trial court judge, almost badgered her to get her to agree she could be fair and impartial. She repeatedly stated that without any coaching from either the trial court judge or the prosecutor. Any further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Welch.
Mr. Gaskell.
Your Honor, thinking about this case, I felt somewhat like, at times, a sacrificial lamb walking into these chambers. That what I'm asking you to do is ignore the United States Supreme Court and literally use the state of Wisconsin law and interpret it differently than they did in Martinez-Salazar. And my question then was, what if the federal law simply did away with peremptory challenges? Okay? Would we in fact follow in their footsteps? Because they said, the judge is sitting there and he's able to strike these jurors and thereby we get a fair and impartial jury after some questioning. Certainly I don't think that's the case, and I think part of probably all of our frustration is that the Ramos law and its progeny over the years has indicated that we do need to err on the side of exclusion of these prospective jurors. And I think part of our frustration is, as we all know, that in a homicide case, we have a courtroom full of people sitting back there as prospective jurors, and when we get a close call, and I don't even think it's a close call in this case, when we have a juror that sits there as DF did, we need simply to err on the side of exclusion so we don't end up. And the frustration is that I think the trial courts and even the prosecutors have basically ignored almost the law of Ramos.
Let me ask you this. What's wrong with the argument that what you're really asking us to do is to grant your client a new trial, even though your client had a fair and impartial jury? Isn't that what you're asking us to do?
Well, Your Honor, and again, and I certainly understand that was your argument in Ramos, and it's...
And I'm not giving it up, right?
And it still is your argument, Your Honor. And I understand that argument, but as I indicated earlier, and I don't mean to be redundant, but literally, and as Ms. Welsh indicated, Mr. Lindell's never argued in about the composition of this jury. But in fact, Your Honor, when we start looking at how the legislature set forth the distinction between for-cause strikes and peremptory strikes, the way that is developed through the course of the jury selection is, in fact, going to affect the composition of the jury that does, in fact, sit there in the end. And again, I understand, as I indicated, that the exception to the rule is when the minority can flip-flop the majority, but that person that sits there and where a peremptory could have been used as somebody else if DF had been struck for cause and sat and been impaneled on that jury, it certainly, there's a question as to how could that have affected the outcome of the trial. And it's simply the fact that I'm frustrated in that to use peremptory challenges as cures for trial court error in not removing prospective jurors for cause. That's my frustration. And I certainly understand and appreciate what the United States Supreme Court has said, but again, this court, as you've indicated, can interpret the Wisconsin case law as well as statutory law and make its own decision.
And that's your answer to Justice Babbage's question to opposing counsel about the level playing field. So what you just said has to do with a level playing field.
That's correct. And again, to have predisposed jurors sit on the panel that shouldn't be there, I think, does not make it a level playing field from the get-go.
Predisposed from either way.
Correct. Correct.
Whether it's first degree or...
Yeah, I agree with that. And we've talked a little bit about Gesh and Justice Scalia's concurrence. And the question is, well, I'm
sorry. You may finish your sentence.
I think he's accurate in that, and as I indicated in my brief, when we as trial counsel sit at the table next to our client, just moments earlier, we tried to remove a juror for cause and made the argument to the court as to why this person is biased. And then in the next minute when we're striking the jurors, we need to turn to our client and say, okay, well, we can't get rid of juror number 10, even though we wanted to get rid of him 2 minutes earlier, to save possibly an appellate issue. And Justice Scalia, I think, is right. I think that brings into the question of, well, didn't you in fact weigh that? And then we end up in a situation that I think is difficult to compromise.
Well, that's not the only option you're left with, though, under those circumstances. You can exercise the peremptory against that juror and make a record of which juror or jurors you might have used that peremptory against and the reasons for it, and preserve the issue for appeal later, and then it's subject to the customary harmless error or evaluation for harm that occurs in many other cases of statutory and constitutional violations, right?
I agree with that, and certainly that wasn't the case here.
But what's wrong with that kind of a system? Doesn't that protect the defendant's right to an impartial jury, which is what we're really talking about here, right? And due process rights.
Due process rights.
So doesn't that accomplish the task?
We certainly take some steps toward preserving that, yes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I appreciated the opportunity.
Ms. Welsh, thank you, Mr. Vasquez.